This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and The Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotte, and in the studio this week, I'm joined by Rory K. Smith, Tony Cascarino, and from his lovely gaff in Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay. Coming up, we'll be talking Newcastle, Southampton, previewing Liverpool and Chelsea in the League Cup, and we'll also have the much-beloved Quick Hits. But first, we're heading to the Etihad.
It's a rare respite for Arsenal in the second half. As Cathola swings it in. Oh, Giroud scored! Against the run of play, the Gunners double their lead.
Ollie, I'm going to let you start on this. A very different Arsenal showed up than the one most people expected.
A lot of people have concentrated on the formation and things that they did differently. I mean, we've seen Arsenal line up in that way, in that shape before in big games. I think the difference was one of attitude, really. I think they after an uncomfortable first couple of minutes where they weren't getting the ball much, I thought they looked like they'd shrugged off the inferiority complex of recent seasons, by which I don't mean the last one or two, I mean the four, five, six seasons in terms of a lot of these bigger games. And they had a way to make sure that they suppressed City. When City were in possession, they had Silva when he had the ball, and they were also very, very intelligent, and that's the word I would use, intelligent, in the way they used the ball themselves. They didn't try to dominate possession.
Cass, Ollie talks about them being more efficient and this change in attitude. Mm. I think to a layperson, it looked like they said, well, why don't we defend in numbers and hit them in the break and have, you know, and have a lot of edge and intensity about us and so on. Viewed from the outside, the reaction might be, why don't they do this more often in terms of, like, you know, Sanchez and Casorla, like the wide spaces and everything. Mm. Is it that hard for a football club to go and change your attitude, or well, for a team?
It's been that hard for Arsene Wenger and his Arsenal, because it was very different, and I think it took us all by surprise, because we didn't expect them, their fullbacks, to be quite rigid, conservative, didn't venture too far forward. You know, we had guys like Ollie said working their socks off. You know, Cazorla, I've never seen tackle so much. You know, it was just a team ethic that we don't associate with Arsenal. I always feel that Arsenal are going to make a mistake, an individual one. I think last year's game, the opening goal was a set piece. It was typical that Di Mikaias wins a header, then Aguero gets on the end of it. But they just denied space to City. And not doing a job on David Silva, but making sure that his options were very limited when he got the ball, having bodies around him. And it made it... Look, he's fantastic in tight areas. He can find a pass. But I think as a team... it was something that we haven't seen from Arsenal. And yes, they should do it more often.
Well, sorry, you've been there, though. I mean, I'm assuming Wenger doesn't go and tell, because in other games, I'm assuming he doesn't go and tell Cazorla, you know, be less intense in the tackle and whatever else, work less hard. He may have told his fullbacks to be more conservative in this game. But again, why doesn't this happen more often? Is this a shift in Wenger, or is it actually difficult when you train to play a certain way and then in a game you have to change it all up again?
Well, I think he must have taken something on board from last year. They were hammered away from home by the teams. Now, you can enter a game and go into a game against City and think, we'll take them on and we'll try and play our way and everybody plays an adventurous style that you can get bodies into areas that cause City problems. No one doubts Arsenal's ability to score goals. We all know that whether it's Giroud, Sanchez, Kozolan, Ramsey, there's numbers of goals in there. So even if you're defending against a team that are very good and very gifted, you always are a threat. But they've gifted so many goals. It's not they've been beaten 1-0 in these games. They were beaten fives and sixes. I thought, has Wenger really learned? Because it's been a long time coming, but it felt like something very... If it wasn't Arsenal shirts, it wouldn't have been an Arsenal team. You wouldn't have... You know, if you'd have looked at the game and not realised it was the Arsenal shirt, you'd have gone, that wasn't an Arsenal performance.
Against Chelsea earlier this season, did they try and do something? Were they a bit tighter? I mean, they lost 2-0. And I suspect from memory, an early goal trying to change it. But was that a signpost? And the same at Anfield, obviously you're playing a much worse Liverpool team. Was that a signpost that Wenger was becoming a bit more pragmatic away from home? And it just took. It was. I think the other thing you've got to factor in is how bad City were. City kind of played into Arsenal's hands because they played with no tempo at all for the first half. They were, as Ollie says in his excellent match report today, they were okay for 15 minutes after the break, but they weren't. They didn't really test Arsenal at any point. That has to be a factor. Arsenal played well, but City played badly, and those two things aren't unrelated, and they are reciprocal.
Ollie, why did City play badly?
Highlighted the fact that Yaya Toure was missing, and you know that is an issue. I mean, if you go back to, I'm trying to think, did Company play in Rome? I don't think he did he? I mean, all of those players were on the night that they produced their best performance of the season. City are capable of playing without those players, and Fernando and Fernandinho are capable well as a central midfield partnership, as they showed in Rome. But I thought it was incredibly subdued. From about the third minute onwards, you sort of feel the intensity go from them. And I wonder if when you play against Arsenal, scoring early, as a lot of the bigger teams have tended to do against them, particularly in home matches against Arsenal, I wonder if that can build up confidence and maybe failing to get that early goal against Arsenal, maybe that just gives Arsenal a bit more confidence to start playing their way. And we saw Arsenal eventually start to play the game on their own terms. And I mean, it's hard to explain City's performance beyond the three players I mentioned, Toure absent and Aguero and Company evidently not at full fitness. But I mean, you could say the same of Arsenal. Ramsey was just back after injury, and you know, he did a great job.
Cazorla, I think most would have as the man of the match, but the guy who kind of embodied this change was Francis Coquelin, coming in, sitting in front of the back four. He's one of those guys who's been at the club a while, but you know, gets sent out on loan, comes back, and you never quite know what to make of him. Is he that impressive, Rory? Is he, or did he just? Was it the right man, right place, right time? And we need to kind of withhold judgment until we see more of them.
He's clearly not a bad player. Obviously, it would be ridiculous to say he's a bad player. I suspect it's more that he has played well because he shows how important it is that Arsenal have someone playing that role rather than he is kind of this world-class player who Arsenal have just kind of forgotten about for the last 4 years. He's been out on loan a couple of times, I think. That he's one of those that you look at it and you wonder whether Arsenal really believed that he was going to come through. They seemed to have lost faith with him. You can tell from his squad number 34. That's not the shirt you give to someone you think is going to be a major player for you. But I've seen him a couple of times now, despite not being at the Etihad yesterday. He's a good footballer, and he does that job really well, and that is an important job. It's what Arsenal have been crying out for. It's what Arteta doesn't really do when he's fit, for all Arteta's benefits. He can't cover the ground, he doesn't close down spaces, he doesn't do all that sort of dirty stuff that Coquelin seems happy to do. So yes, he's done really well. Whether they'd do even better with a better player than Coquelin playing that role, I don't know.
He's basically behind Arteta and Flamini in the pecking order, right?
He certainly was about 3 weeks ago. I don't know if he is now. Same with the goalkeeper. You look at the performances, and Wenger, ultimately, we can sort of say, oh, you've got to bring your big names back and blah, 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 and they did it with Chesney. Coquelin's played well. I don't see any reason to drop him.
It sort of typified his bench, didn't it? If you looked at his substitutes bench, you look at people like Gibbs, who would be guaranteed to walk back into the team. Didn't happen. You know, you looked at Ozil, you're sort of thinking, you've paid a lot of money for him, and he's been out injured, but he didn't come back in. Sort of Wenger went for a much more, what he felt was reliable players that would do a job on the day, which was quite surprising because normally Wenger does love to put his players back in, which it took me a bit by surprise.
Would I be allowed to say something about City? They are capable of that. They are capable. Every time I've seen City this season, you invariably get about half an hour, 45 minutes where they kind of do nothing and then they kind of turn it on when they have to and it's normally enough to get them a win. They have this side to them that is very kind of listless and lacklustre. And I know they've gone 14 unbeaten before yesterday, but that side to them is there and it is always there and it's never far from the surface, that they are capable of turning in a kind of slapdash performance. And I think the reason that so many people, even when they closed the gap to Chelsea, the reason that so many people said Chelsea are still going to win the title, not necessarily that comfortably, but moderately comfortably, is because City always look like dropping points.
And an awful lot of the time, they're bailed out by individuals and by, you know, whether it's Touré stepping up a gear or Silva or Aguero producing some magic. I mean, they've won the league twice, but they've scraped the league on the occasions they've won it. There's no real intensity about them a lot of the time, and that's where I would worry about City.
There's a real bothered attitude, it feels, from the manager to the team. I mean, it's so obvious that Aguero wasn't fit. You know, and we know Vincent Kompany hadn't played for a number of weeks, and you could tell that he was a bit flat-footed at times. Aguero looked so unfit to me. I'm looking and thinking, there was an incident late in the second half. He got caught out, and he tried to chase back to defend as a centre-forward, and he was going backwards. And we know how quick Aguero could be. You know, what happens in the Champions League and the outcome of the league and how City perform in the next, three or four months, is going to decide Pellegrini. It's, you know, at the moment, I look at City, even when they've won titles, I felt, do you know what, they should have won them at Kanto. They've got such a superior squad. I thought last year was typical, and the year they won when Aguero scored in the last second of the game against United. Yes, City was so much better than everybody else.
Sorry, but that you touched on a point that you said they were so much better than everybody else.
Yeah.
Are you talking about what? Performances? Or are you saying
players
like,
because that's
kind of the crux of the issue, right? Because when you say they were better, if we're talking they were better in terms of performances, and yet they only won with that last second goal, then you could say that they were actually a bit unlucky. If they were so much better because they had a much better squad, but they weren't actually playing to the level of that squad, then that's a different issue. And that's a knock on the manager.
I would go that the level of their squad, they should have won a lot more and got a lot more points. Gab, there's some games you just knew that City would just turn the heat down and just not perform.
All right. I want to ask you about the penalty, the way Kompany defended on Nacho Monreal and Monreal going down. Was this clear cut to you?
I think Kompany gets himself in an awkward position, which is a bit flat-footed. But I also think that Monreal was absolutely knowing where he wants to go over and what part of the body he can use from Kompany to go over. And it was just an outstuck leg slightly. There's no intention of a foul. He doesn't look to try and look for, does he, Monreal? It's more Monreal looks for him, but he gets caught knowing.
But it's a penalty because the defender isn't in a position where he's allowing the attacker to win the penalty?
Allow Ollie a say, but I'm surprised there's so much debate about it. It was a penalty. It was obviously a penalty. Kompany steps across him. A penalty.
It's funny because that's exactly what Paolo Di Canio said on Italian television, whereas Robbie Savage said the opposite, as I recall last night. Ollie, where do you stand?
I thought it was one of those growing number of things that you could call both foul and a dive. I think it's perfectly possible for there to be both. Kompany stepped across him, I think, in order to block him and was blocking him, but Monreal absolutely made sure that there was contact by throwing himself into the challenge. I thought it was a penalty, and whether you can book somebody for diving when it's when a foul's given, I don't know, but I thought a penalty and a dive.
Ollie, at some point when Ivory Coast are finished with the Cup of Nations, Wilfred Bony will come back. What do you think happens? Does he go straight in? Can he revitalize them? Does it mean less minutes for Dzeko?
Well, I think it probably means less minutes for Aguero, because it means he can actually be rested to an extent. He doesn't need to play twice a week, which they would hope to be doing by that stage of the season, if indeed they get past Barcelona. Pellegrini was asked about it last night, and he said, well, it's not a case of adding a striker, it's a case of replacing Negredo, who they sold. And obviously they've gone one up this season, but Bony is seen as somebody who can play up there on his own, who can play with Aguero, with Dzeko, with Jovetic, and be more of a spearhead when Aguero is missing.
Cass, I want to give you the final word on this, because you were well, certainly you were more of a Boney Dzeko type than you were an Aguero type. Can two big men...
Cass looks a bit disappointed at that.
Can two big men, and I know obviously Boney is perhaps more dynamic than Dzeko, and Dzeko's maybe more technical, but can you play with two strikers like that, Boney and Dzeko together? Is that a rational partnership given the way City play behind them?
I've always felt that good players can play together, whether they're big, small or ever. And of course, if they can't do certain things, if you have two centre forwards who can't head a ball, then you've got a problem if you've got wingers who are going to cross them. So I've seen Boney score goals with his head. You know, I've seen Aguero get goals with his head. So even when crosses come in, could they play together? Why not? I'd be pretty shocked that they would fail that miserably. Well, I've always been very wary of saying that's only one road of success, is to have big man, small man. I've seen two big men play together. I've seen two smaller lads and cause massive problems.
Can you? I'm a genuine question. I'll throw this out to everybody. Can somebody suggest a club or a team in recent years where that has had two guys that size and with those characteristics playing together up front? And you can't mention PSG because obviously Cavani starts from a wide area.
Can't really think off the top of my head, but then I hadn't seen a team play with no centre forward.
Chris Sutton and Alan Shearer, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, what, big? Yeah. Oh, are you going for big? Yeah, I've seen big partnerships. Okay. Me and Sheringham.
Yep.
I would argue neither Boney nor Dzeko is really a Sheringham type, but yeah.
Oh, well, okay.
I'd argue that Ferdinand Castorino is not really a Boney or a Dzeko.
Ferdinand? Just stop it. Sheringham and Ferdinand, would you?
Yeah. But perhaps that's it.
Boney's, I mean, he's 6 foot, but he's not characterised as a big man. I mean, in terms of, he's a quick, strong striker rather than somebody who particularly uses his height. I know he's good in the air, but he's not. I don't think he would force City to play in a different way.
I don't like City at all when they play with two strikers.
Even
when one of them's Aguero, I think it slows them up too much.
So your verdict would be kind of thumbs down.
I think Aguero is a brilliant footballer, but I think he does give them a little bit of a problem in the way that brilliant footballers often do, in that I can understand why Pellegrini wants a more physical presence next to him, because I'm not sure he has the physicality to lead a line in the Premier League, despite his extraordinary ability. But I just think with two strikers up there, then sort of Nasri and Silva tucked in behind, they get too narrow and the play becomes very stodgy and very kind of treacly.
And it's been a very cagey start to the second half. Reid, long with a touch. And here is Elliot again! And he scored again!
Speaking of treacly, let's move over to the northeast, where Newcastle hosted Southampton and lost. Obviously, it's been a theme all season long. We're waiting for Southampton to drop off. They never do. Ollie, I was particularly surprised because they don't have Schneiderlin, they don't have Wanyama, and they go and they take all 3 points. And obviously, they don't have Saito Mane and Jay Rodriguez. Was this a bit of a smash and grab, as maybe Rory's mate John Carver suggested?
Wasn't their most fluent performance. It wasn't as convincing a performance as the performance at Old Trafford a week earlier, when, according to Louis van Gaal, they were dominated by Manchester United. But I mean, you just talk about no Wanyama, no Schneiderlin, but I mean, they put Harrison Reed in there. Harrison Reed is, what is he, 19? Another product of their academy, and he did a very decent job in front of the back four, and Ward-Prowse involved in the pressing game further forward. And I thought, without looking anywhere near their best, they again look like a proper team who know how they're going to play. And I think that makes an awful lot of difference. There are a lot of teams in that top half at the moment, bigger teams, Liverpool, Manchester United, you know, who look uncertain about the way they're meant to be playing at times. Southampton, I think they look like a team. They look like they know what they're doing. They look like they believe in what they're doing. And I think that is an encouraging sign.
You know, one of the narratives is like, oh, they learned all this under Pochettino. But they have a lot of new guys who weren't there last year. You know, just Gardos, Pele, Tadic, and so on, Bertrand. How difficult is it to explain to players to do, I mean, it's a very stupid question here, but you know, explain to players how you want them to play, especially when it is somewhat sophisticated, the way Southampton play? And why can't other teams do it?
Well, I think if you simplify it for players, tell them the don'ts and what you don't want to do, and if you make extreme measures, if they do the opposite to what you tell them, the penny will drop really quickly.
What do you mean by extreme measures? Like, well, making you run the stadium?
I've known
steps?
Managers that have it's told players before games in dressing room, say, if you do that, I'm pulling you off.
And that's in the negative sense.
You mean metaphorically?
Yeah. I'll take you out of the game. And a player was, I remember John Sheridan saying to me, saying, Big Jack's just sold me, if I play a 1-2 off the centre forward, he's going to pull me off before the game. I said, well, don't play 1-2 then, John. So he didn't, because Jack wanted him to play in a certain style. Now, that's extreme. But I do know that if you set a team up, and Southampton's clearly, their record tells you, their goals against stats tells you that they are well drilled in what they're doing. Players know the positioning they're in. And far too many managers don't know how to set up, and I've had this conversation with Rory, set up a team to not concede goals, where Brendan Rodgers has said it's quite easy. It's not easy. As a team, it's very difficult to defend as a unit, where everyone will do a role in the side that will complement their partner. If it's the left side of the pitch, the two left players know what to do. If it's the right side, what two centre-halves? Where, you know, watching Cahill and John Terry is quite simple. You know, they both, I mean, Saturday they played the game. They could have played it if they were 90 together. It was so easy for them in front, but they still know their jobs. And that's, I think, the basis of Southampton, is that you've got good players doing simple things very well. It's not that complicated to stay in positions that are asked. You know, Arsenal was a bit different, as we talked about earlier, because they haven't done that type of performance. That was a very unlike Arsenal, what we've seen. But Southampton have been that nearly every game. Yeah, they've lost a few along the way, but they've won a lot.
Carver, and the reason I keep bringing up Carver and Rory together is because Rory made a funny in the game today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
About John Carver, something along the lines of... Do you explain it?
John Carver said that he was surprised Jermaine Defoe had left Toronto, that it was a real party city, and I am baffled by who in Toronto would invite John Carver to a party.
I'm also baffled as to if that's your standard for party city. I mean, I would have thought Newcastle might be more of a party
Newcastle
city.
Newcastle is a party city, yeah, that's true.
Than Toronto.
Although it's also a city with a tremendous amount of culture and real heart, I think we should point that out.
Why would John Carver say that anyway?
Well, he worked in Toronto, didn't he?
No, but why?
He partied in Toronto.
He partied really hard in Toronto.
He was a club promoter in Toronto in the Acid House years.
But is he associating Jermaine Defoe with a party animal all the time?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I just thought it was a really strange thing to
say. Which, given that Jermaine Defoe couldn't settle in Toronto because he missed his mum, is perhaps missing the point entirely.
On a serious note, Carver very unhappy that no penalty was awarded for José Fontaine ball.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Kind of has a point, yeah.
It was a handball, yeah.
It was.
But this is a bigger subject, but we've got into a ridiculous situation with the referees now, where you can see it every weekend. The referees are terrified of making decisions, and it's our fault. It's all of our faults. The media, the managers, the players, the fans, it's everyone's fault. We only have ourselves to blame.
Well, we'll be getting more on that in the quick hits when I bring up Mr. Martinez and what he's done. But Ollie, I want to get your take on this, and I've read George Culkin like everybody should. I don't remember seeing a guy in an interim position like Carver is, who's lobbying so hard and so openly and so honestly. There's almost a whiff of desperation about it. It also seems obvious to me that if you're Ashley, don't like to spend money, then maybe what you do is you're not going to get relegated. Just give the job to Carver till the end of the season and then figure things out in the interim. What's the problem here? What's your take?
That they might well go down that road that you talk about. Just let it drift to the end of the season, and whether John Carver's any good or not as a manager, unless they get to the point they did, what was it now, six seasons ago. I think, knowing what I do about Ashley, I think that would be his preference, to let things drift, to not have to pay a compensation for somebody to get, and maybe to get somebody cheap at the end of the season rather than get somebody cheap now.
But so why not appoint Carver now? I mean, well, why not just say, Carver, the job is yours through the end of the season, and then we'll see. Well, why make this guy go beg for a job after every game?
They might well do that, you know, as a sort of to the end of the season type job. But I mean, I think it would be very much a sort of interim appointment.
Do you have to pay him more if you make him an official interim?
Well, pay him whatever you like, right?
Do you? I mean, you should. You certainly should. But I mean, I can't imagine. I can't imagine that Pardew was exactly one of the. Well, he wasn't one of the highest paid Premier League managers when he was at Newcastle. He's actually getting more money at Crystal Palace. So the budget that Mike Ashley on a Newcastle manager is not going to be big enough to get the sort of high caliber candidate that Newcastle fans are. That's a concern.
They mentioned on Match of the Day. There was a thing in it when they lost to Chelsea. I can't remember who was commentating. You shouldn't criticise commentators, so they are very good. But someone said, oh, you know, if they keep on playing like this, the job will be John Carver's. And you sort of thought, well, they have just lost. It doesn't matter how they've played. They've now lost like two games in a row. But there was someone on Match of the Day on Saturday, they talked about the potential candidates. And obviously Remy Gard's been linked. And they listed Frank de Boer and somebody else who was quite high profile. Frank de Boer is not going to go to Newcastle. Jurgen Klopp is not going to go to Newcastle because Newcastle is, wrongly, but it is, a club completely devoid of ambition. It is a graveyard for an ambitious manager. The idea that Ashley could even tempt someone like Frank de Boer, who at some point is going to manage Barcelona, is ridiculous.
You seem so sure about what Frank de Boer's future is going to be. Can I just ask, why has he impressed you so much?
No, it's just that he's a former Barcelona player. He's Dutch. He's going to manage Barcelona. It's that simple. Same as Koeman.
As Boudewijn Zenden, Winston Bogart,
they will all get
Michael Reitziger. They're all going to go.
They will all get their chance.
Yes, Patrick Kluivert. Okay, got it.
It's a club with no identity, and the fans feel that.
Did you say a club with no identity?
As in where they're heading, and I don't feel it's a club of identity on the football field, Gab, from the fans' perspective. I don't feel that from that football club. There's no heart in Newcastle at the moment. And if you accept mediocrity, and if that's what Carver's going to give them to the end of the season, a guy that clearly has been an assistant, you know, the fans are just going to feel, what is happening here? And they've been thinking that for years. Gab, if you used to write mediocre columns, but you don't, if you did, people wouldn't read them. And in a minute, Newcastle fans are going to turn their back. Because if they go into next year, they need something up there. It's always been a club that thrives on excitement, and like a lot of football clubs do. But I think Newcastle is even more than most. They love the excitement of the town. Now, I know they can't do a Kevin Keegan again, what they did. But I'll tell you what, I think Mike Ashley seriously has to think about giving something back to the fans that will bring something exciting to that football club again.
They do have exciting players. They've got some young players who are now in the team. I mean, Dummett's, I think, has done a good job this year. I just think they have, above all, a communications problem. And I wonder if maybe you had somebody who spoke in a very straight way to the fans and say, look, realistically, because of geography, because of history, because I'm not Mansour or Abramovich, we are not going to be competing for the Premier League title. But it can give you is homegrown youngsters, exciting football, be with us, we're special, blah, blah, blah. I'm wondering if a message like that would resonate with the fans more than what you've been getting.
I think there's a massive misconception of Newcastle fans that they're demanding. I think there are no less demanding fans in Britain than Newcastle fans. As you say, they want decent football, decent team, and they want a team to have a go, as George Tolkien has written in his brilliant piece in The Game Today, cross-promotion. There's ways and means of finishing 10th in the Premier League. You can finish 10th in the Premier League just by sort of thinking, right, we'll get there eventually, it doesn't really matter how, we'll get rid of the cups, we don't care about them. Or you can say, right, we are going to have young players, we're going to have a smattering of local talent or up-and-coming players who we will then sell on. We will try and play in an exciting way. Newcastle don't need to be stagnant to finish 10th. They can be exciting and still finish 10th.
But you still need to communicate that.
Yeah, you're right.
You need to be clear with the fans and stuff.
This is what we're doing.
That's what. No, but we don't own Newcastle, not yet, anyway.
But is it not was it your idea or is it someone else's idea that Newcastle are the perfect candidates to be the British Bilbao? Was that your idea?
No, it was. You know whose idea that was?
Go
wasn't
on.
That way, way back when, before you were born? Wasn't that the John Hall and Freddie Shepherd and those guys?
Was
that
not
their
before
idea?
I was born. No, I don't think that was their idea. Their idea was vanity signings and Alan Shearer. Newcastle, they've missed that boat for, you know, to be City or Chelsea. They've missed that billionaire boat. probably a yacht, in fairness. They have to find another way to have a, to carve a place, a niche in the Premier League. Ooh. And it's not a bad idea to say, look, we are going to try and do this locally. That meets Mike Ashley's I want to be cheap requirement, but it would also get the fans on board.
League Cup Tuesday coming up, Liverpool and Chelsea. Liverpool, maybe a bit of a bounce. Chelsea devastating at the weekend. Cass, on paper, this game is more important for Liverpool than it is for Chelsea, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think they've because they've turned a corner, and sort of Rodgers has gone back with a formation where he's gone back to the, you know, the pace up front and getting Barini in there, and, you know, using the Lallanas, Coutinhos, the Sterlings to be influential in the outcome of a game. And they've been quite a tighter team. Unfortunately, going back to my, you know, what I felt at the weekend, the way Swansea play, I think it fits Chelsea. I just think Chelsea love teams who want to play in certain areas where they can rub the ball off them. A bit like they did last year in the 2-0 game at Anfield. I think that's the big test for Liverpool. Can they not get caught by Chelsea waiting like vultures to get the ball off them?
Roy, Brendan rested some key players like Mario Balotelli. No, I'm just kidding. He rested Steven Gerrard ahead of this game. Is the matchup? I mean, if he does go three at the back, bearing in mind that, you know, maybe his three at the back has slightly more ball playing elements to it than for example United's. Is it really playing into Chelsea's hands that much?
No, not necessarily. I think the three at the back is actually. Yeah, I think it's broadly worked for Liverpool, that system. I think their defence, since they lost 3-0 at United, which was when they first started playing it, I think they might have the best defence in the league since that game.
Uh-huh.
Which suggests that something is going right. The one thing I would say is that with Liverpool, it does look more like it's more by luck than judgement that they've got the best defence in the league since that game. They never looked particularly secure. They are very slowly building some sort of momentum, Liverpool. I think Chelsea is an important test. They don't necessarily have to win over the course of the tie, but they certainly have to give them a game, because otherwise psychologically it could be quite a damaging experience. I think Chelsea will have too much for them. It'll depend a little bit on how strong the side is that Mourinho puts out, but if Liverpool can match them, especially at Anfield, Liverpool to do with a trophy, I'd be more inclined to go for the Europa League than the Carling Cup, the Capital One Cup. I think the crucial thing is not getting swatted aside by Chelsea, because I think psychologically that could be quite damaging.
Cass, if you're Mourinho, obviously you've rotated almost nothing this year, generally always playing the same guys. You've got the big clash with Manchester City coming up at the end of the month, at which point you could be, if you win that, you're 8 points clear and laughing. In between, you've got the FA Cup game against Bradford, which, no disrespect, is Bradford. Do you think maybe this is, you play your starters here, and then if you are going to rest, you rest in the FA Cup?
I've never felt Mourinho works that way, Gab. I've always felt that it's a bit of an axe to grind with Liverpool, isn't it? When he got knocked out in the Champions League and the manner that it happened. I think he loves to rub salt in the wounds of the big rivals. And I think he'll look at Liverpool and think that if we just put another nail in their coffin and show that we're a far better and superior team, then I think he'll do that. And like you said, Bradford is a game that he will probably make changes if he's going to. I don't see it being the League Cup.
But there's not that many players that Mourinho can rotate in. There's a few. There's Schürrle could come in. Salah, possibly, unless he gets sold.
Ramirez, Mikel, Zuma.
Yeah, but Zuma's been playing anyway, so that, you know, that's not as clear-cut as it was a couple of months ago. Zuma and Cahill. Cahill is obviously still first choice, but Zuma, they don't have a huge amount of cover. You've got the fullbacks.
Loftus-Cheek, Izzy Harris, Nathan Ake.
Yeah, you could bring the kids in, but he won't do that against Liverpool. And I'm not even sure that Mourinho, knowing Mourinho, will do that against Bradford.
Yeah.
I don't think you didn't expect to see three or four kids start against Bradford.
I think he loves winning football games.
I'm sure he does. I still worry in the back of my mind that these guys are playing too many minutes and it could have disastrous consequences later on when it matters. But, you know, maybe he's gambling on getting that 8-point lead, and then you can start rotating in the Premier League and go after
the Champions League. But then at the same time, I think Chelsea's squad is not massive. I've been impressed, actually, that Mourinho's not really complained about it, but they've only got kind of 18, 19 senior players.
Time now for some quick hits. Chelsea demolish Swansea 5-0, and having watched the game, I can tell you it could have been 10 in the first half. Cass, anything to add other than the fact that Diego Costa ought to be administered in small doses?
Just before the game, I felt it was the most perfect game for Chelsea, playing Swansea in the manner they do. You know, the type of football they play. They want to play in bad areas, overplay. Fits Chelsea perfectly. And it ended up being the result that I thought it would be close to.
Bad to worse for Paul Lambert, who's no longer Paul Lambert. Brendan Rodgers thinks, and I quote, that nobody could do a better job than Lambert in those circumstances. Liverpool win 2-0 and Fabio Borini breaks the ice. Ollie, Liverpool are actually looking pretty solid defensively. Does this three at the back thing with Chan actually work?
It's a tactic that they've used sort of every now and then under Rodgers. They've never sort of stuck to it slavishly, but it's been an option. I feel like it's the option that gives them most defensive security at the moment, and I think they look more comfortable with it than Manchester United do, for example. I mean, Manchester United continually playing 3-5-2. I don't think it works. Liverpool's, it seems to work, perhaps more than their 4-3-3.
And a very quick bonus question. Is Rodgers just being polite when he says nobody in the universe could do a better job with Villa than Paul Lambert?
Yes.
Manchester United win at QPR, but Van Gaal plays bizarro world with the formation, and the club's travelling support shout 4-4-2, 4-4-2 at him. Plus, I saw Phil Jones taking corner kicks, which struck me as kind of weird. Rory, can you explain Louis Van Gaal's genius?
The only logic, I think, to Phil Jones taking the corners is that there is no one in the world less likely to score from a corner than Phil Jones, so you might as well not bother having him in the box. The 4-4-2 chant, I think it was more, wasn't a specific request for a specific tactic. It was about this 3-3-2-2 is not working. Van Gaal seems to still determine to play it. He had all the evidence he needed on Saturday that it doesn't work. United are much better playing with a flat back four and whatever other formation in midfield. Their win percentage with 3-5-2 is 36%. It's about 80% with other formation.
Well, if it's any consolation, Louis, they used to shout 4-4-2 at Sir Alex Ferguson as well.
Once.
When? It was one time too many, and they should all wash their mouths out with soap. Spurs went against Sunderland 2-1, but the whole world is mystified as to why Jan Vertonghen's goal was disallowed since, as any fool knows, you can't be offside in your own half, unless you're Belgian, evidently. I don't want to put more pressure on referees. I want to be guilty of what Rory said earlier, but Cass, please explain.
How do I explain? What do you mean, please explain? It was obvious. He was onside. He was in his own half. The linesman, obviously, thought he's in the opposing half. It was so blatant. I can't give you an explanation apart from it was there for everybody to see.
Why didn't the referee say something to him? They're communicating with each other. Ask him, like, what did you see? Was he in his own half?
Well, obviously, the position of the referee and the linesman have to be wrong, because if the linesman is not in level with the play, if he's not in level with the play, he obviously wasn't. So then the referee is chasing the play and thinks he's got to the halfway line, because neither of them haven't seen that he hasn't got to the halfway line. It wasn't a half a yard. It was closer to 2 yards, wasn't it? That was the most amazing thing.
I am absolutely mystified that nobody, fourth official, whatever, nobody gets involved, because, you know, one guy can make a mistake, but really all four. Maybe that's a situation which calls for more collaboration between officials. Roberto Martinez has admitted to complaining directly to Mike Riley, the head of the PGMOL, at some of the decisions that have gone against his club this season. And he says, watch this space. In the next six games, maybe things will level out. Ollie, is this acceptable? Kind of makes me uncomfortable that referees making mistakes that help Everton and penalize other teams now. And also, is it acceptable? It's okay for him to talk to the PGMOL, but should he be telling the world that he's spoken to them?
One of several things I very much like about Martinez is the fact that he's not one normally to we're being hard done by game, the referee blaming game. And I think for him to be is an element of if you can't beat them, join them.
Sorry, as an aside, when you're talking about putting pressure, this is the crap that puts pressure on them. You go to somebody's boss and saying, like, hey, make sure you don't make any more mistakes against Everton.
Yep. No, I agree. I
love the guy, but I think he let himself down here.
There is a whole thing about the referees that is getting worse and worse and worse, and we are. It is a vastly complicated subject.
Harry Redknapp keeps telling us he's under no pressure and that reports that he is one defeat away from the sack are all rubbish. Rory, is he wise to be this bullish?
Probably not, no, because if they keep losing games, he will get sacked eventually. I think he's quite fatalistic. I think bullish is the wrong word. I think fatalistic is maybe the right word. I think he knows that there will come a point where everything will sort of crystallise and he may have to go. The concern for QPR is all those difficult home games. The one silver lining is that they've got lots of difficult home games, which means they've got easier away games.
I guess that's true, because you kind of... Well, play everybody, so yeah.
Yeah. There's been this thing that they've played all the hard teams away and they've had the easy games at home, but that means the converse is now true. So it's positive and negative. Gab, one for you. Davy Ginola has joined the race to succeed Sepp Blatter. I assume you are going to tell me that it is just a publicity stunt.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to tell you. When I saw how unprepared he was, when I saw that he's sponsored by a bookmaker, which is completely absurd when you consider that betting on football is illegal in more than half the countries who are going to be voting on it. And I don't think he's going to get the five nominations, which, incidentally, Jerome Champagne today, I'm on his email mailing list, as all good people should be, sent an email put of pleading, help, I might not get my five nominations. Well, gee, there's a surprise.
Do you not think it's a bit of a shame that an actually quite credible challenger in Prince Ali is being kind of shunted to the side by Ginola's ridiculous campaign? Would it not be better if we all supported Prince Ali, who's actually who's done quite a lot of good work and is serious?
That's what UEFA wants. I'm not sure how. I mean, I'm not that sold on Prince Ali either, actually. While I appreciate his colorful background, I don't like the fact that he went to Princeton. It's weird and unusual. Also, I wonder, what's this, like, prince, king? Like, does it have to be royalty here? I don't know.
Credibility of David. Surely he must have thought that doing this publicity stunt, which he clearly is going to hurt him. You know, forget about getting paid. I just thought it was really. David,
then I suppose what else is he going to try and do? Bit of punditry.
Well, doesn't really matter, okay, but I wouldn't want to put myself something to totally have certainly no chance, and then be ridiculed because of what. Surely he must have known that.
It's equivalent of going on Celebrity Big Brother, isn't it? It's a no win, no credibility situation.
Yeah, I don't think he was the only person who was approached, or that he was their first choice either. But the way this has been handled has been really cack-handed, if I may say. Right, any other business?
Me and Cass are both wearing the same jumper.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. It's a purple jumper. I think the collar's slightly different.
Yeah, Cass's is V-necked. Mine is a round neck.
Yes.
Well, I think we both look very fetching.
You certainly do. And
Ollie, are you wearing a purple jumper?
No.
Are you dressed?
Not yet. Just slippers.
All right, I'll leave that to everybody's imagination. That's all we've got time for this week. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes and Player FM for Android, please do so. Many thanks to my guest today, the very excellent Ollie Kay. Also, Tony Cascarino and Rory K. Smith. Check out thetimes.co.uk. If you're not a member yet, you can take our £1 digital trial today. Just search Timesport online. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.